Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Another quiet week, I think. Quiet.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of news.
Almost too quiet.
Yeah. maybe. I mean, it ends up with that thing where it's like the news cycles then seize upon kind of the, that's when you get the weird stories and they stick around for a little bit because there's not anything to draw attention away from it. Like you get this thing about this guy that they hired and now fired.
Yeah.
For being not great.
Yeah. Several podcasts recorded while that was still an issue before they fired him.
including mine.
Including
yes.
Yours,
we recorded.
Yeah.
Yep. We recorded about it. I took full credit. We recorded released our bootleg. And by the time the full episode came out, he was gone. So I really think
you did it.
We did it.
Oh, no. Well, that's because Apple executives listen to the Rebound exclusively. And they're like, oh, no.
Only, apparently to the bootleg, too, which is the best part.
Well,
they don't even bother with the,
they got all the money
for the final episode.
They can shell out all that money for the bootleg. They can
that. I appreciate the subscriptions.
Okay. You know, without belaboring it, because it was belabored on several podcasts that you could listen to, and the guy isn't going to work at Apple. The part that gets me, and you know, Casey Newton, who used to work at The Verge, and he's got his Substack that he's doing now, Platformer. He wrote a piece about this today that was about how, and he framed it in a way that was a little different than the way that I was thinking of it, but I think it is pretty close. Which is, we live in a world where employees have more of a say of what happens at their companies than used to be the case, and it's because they can make their voices heard.
Yep.
And put pressure on the people who hire and fire. And it used to be sort of like, well, we hired this guy. And then if you didn't like it, too bad. I mean, what are you going to do? They hired him. And now the answer is you tweet about it and you bring the receipts and you show how awful he is. And then it becomes a whole public story and it's a PR problem. And then they're like, yeah, he's not going
to. So here's the fascinating thing about that, too, which is this is one place where I would argue Apple has really made substantive changes since like the Steve Jobs era. I mean, I don't think something like this could have happened. And not just because social media was in a different place, but like, I think about how long, you know, Apple employees were on Twitter, for example, could not say they were Apple employees.
Yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
They were usually
talk
arounds, right? Like they would say like they work at Fruit Company in California or something, right? Like you'd see the little, you know,
not disingenuous,
but like the little like
hints,
covert clues, right?
Yeah.
But now, not only can they do that, but they can tweet about the company making mistakes. And again, I don't think that would have happened in the Steve Jobs era at all.
for sure. And you know, it's funny. So people are talking in the tech sphere about this Apple thing, and the guy, like, I mean, The Verge did. I think it was The Verge did a really great piece where they basically said, well, look, okay, maybe this thing that was quoted was from his book was taken out of context, and then they get like three pages of context and they're like, oh, it's all like this.
Yep.
and so one of my thoughts is, who hired this guy?
Yeah.
And how did they hire him? I mean, he also wrote a bunch of ideas pieces for Wired, which I think is a red flag in and of itself. The ideas pieces, like, it's big. I'm a big thinker. I'm a deep thinker. And it turns out that was sort of also kind of image rehab after he did this book. And he, you know, so how do you hire somebody like this not knowing that this is in his background and that it's going to be an issue? I find
it
seems to me that it's either a lack of due diligence on the part of whoever was hiring it, or it's somebody who knew that this was in the background and was just hoping to sneak it by, hires all the time. And so this is, I want to bring it up because this isn't just about one issue and it isn't just about tech. It's about how hiring practices always have happened and how they've changed. And the example I want to give is the athletic director at Northwestern University. And for those who are not tuned into sports stuff, Northwestern lost its athletic director, did a national search for a new athletic director. Whoa, it turns out the best candidate is the guy who is an associate athletic director at Northwestern, who was sitting right down the hall. Amazing. I'm glad you did a national search to hire the guy you know who's probably your friend, right? And this is not news. This is how hires happen all the time. It's like, oh,
absolutely,
we're going to pick the best person for the job. It's in the bag for Bob, right?
Yeah. Right. So, well, I mean, because you have to cover your base, right? Like right. a lot of these cases, they mandate, right? Like a lot of organizations mandate.
You make it seem
if you're going to post this job, you have to open it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to consider all sorts of people. You can't just say we're promoting Bob. You've got to say no. We're going to give it very serious thought, and then they promote Bob anyway. And this has happened since time began. But what happened in this case is, and this is the part that gets me. The guy at Northwestern who they promoted is a party in a lawsuit that includes among the parties in the lawsuit the university itself. He is accused in the lawsuit of taking allegations of, I believe it's sexual misconduct by a coach, and sweeping them under the rug. And this is being litigated right now.
Why would you hire that guy?
So, well, this
why would you promote that guy?
This is the thing, and they promoted that guy, and they hired that guy. And that's the part that gets me, is in the old days, he would just get hired, and there would be a press release, and people might grumble about it, but that would be the end of it. And instead, we live in an era where people are like, hey, we have the receipts for this guy. We know about this guy. We looked him up. The student newspaper writes about it, but also it gets on social media and then it gets picked up elsewhere. And he lasted a week and then he was out. But and my point, my point here is not to talk about that, the issue of like, what do people do and can they get jobs and all that. My point is really just to say, and they hired that guy? And the answer is yes. A lot of people got hired who where there's supposed to be due diligence and there wasn't, or they ignored the due diligence because they really wanted to hire this person. And that seems to not, you can't seem to get away with that like you used to. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing that because obviously this is like somebody had it in the bag for that guy who used to work at Facebook at Apple and was like, I know he's got baggage, but boy, he's a really good sales guy, or he's a really good ad tech guy. And so we're just going to bring him in. Yes, he said awful things and he's actually kind of an awful person. Let's just say, I don't know him, but let's just say that that's the attitude of the person who's hiring him. But he's good at his job and he gets results, and that's really what matters, right? And there's nobody to say, no, this is actually kind of not our corporate philosophy to hire people like this. But the person who was making the decision got away with it until they didn't.
Right, right. And it's, there's always a calculus in there too. I'm sure they're doing about like, well, even if this does come out, maybe it doesn't make huge waves, or maybe it lasts a day and then people move on to something else and we'll be fine. We can weather that storm.
And instead, several thousand Apple employees signed a petition saying we don't want to work with somebody like this.
Yeah. So you did the wrong math on that one.
And you can say, I'm gonna internalize a counter argument here. I know that people will say, yeah, but it's just his opinion, man. And it's like, yeah, but if you're a woman who works at Apple and you see that Apple just hired for this high profile job a guy who thinks that the women of Silicon Valley are garbage. He's an unabashed sexist. He's a father and boasts about how great it is to be a parent, and apparently attacks people on the internet who are not parents for being barren and stuff like that. And yet also in his book he describes the act of being parent as that he was tricked into it by a woman who has her wiles and whatever. Like the guy is a sexist pig. There's no doubt about it. The evidence is clear. And if you're a company that values diversity, inclusion, that says that having more women in the workforce is important, mm-hmm. and that you want to change Silicon Valley culture about these sorts of things, you can't hire a guy like this because he's an unrepentant sexist pig. That sends a message to the women who work at Apple.
Yeah, exactly. It's just what it comes down to, and it sends exactly the wrong image that you want to project. Yeah. And I think especially from the top down, right? Like when you have a company that is so dedicated to expressing, even though they are a company and at the end of the day, they are trying to make money, an image is a big part of that, right? Your image benefits your bottom line because if you hold to it, then that is something that people will respond to.
Right. And as Basecamp learned, it's not just about, well, this one guy is going to be effective and so let's hire him. It's you have a whole company with lots of employees and they have to want to work at your company too. And they have to, you have to send a message to all of your employees that they're welcome and that this is a place where they are all going to be treated fairly. And when they hire somebody who basically says women kind of are valueless in Silicon Valley, you know, well, you have a problem with parts of your workforce there.
I mean, it would be like Apple. It would be also like Apple hiring somebody who was like really in favor of strip mining, right? Like, it's like, we're a company that really values the environment and it's super important to us. And here's how we do that. But we also hired this guy.
This miner is really good.
Yeah, he's really good at his mining. You know,
so this is an oil executive. I know he's an oil executive, but boy, the marketing. Yeah, it's in conflict there. Anyway, the guy got let go. So there's that. Also some of the stories are like, you know, sometimes there's the but he's apologized, and when, what's the statute of limitations? It's like, this guy hasn't apologized, so he seems to be pretty much like this anyway. The truth is that a bunch of venture capitalists and stuff have come out and in support of him, and he's cultivated a lot of Silicon Valley VC relationships, so you know,
which tells you exactly what you need to know.
Those guys will use him in some way that gives him money, and they'll just go off, and that'll be that. I had another story I wanted to mention, which you just posted this morning, which is The Verge. Neelay Patel did a review of Starlink, the SpaceX broadband satellite internet thing. And I praised it on Twitter, and apparently that got picked up on TechMeme. And now there are a lot of weirdos in my Twitter feed tweeting about how The Verge once wronged them, or how they love their internet service, which is like, totally beside the point.
Why is every single thing that even is remotely touching Elon Musk, like all of those people come out of the woodwork?
That is a magnifier too, but it's also just social media stuff. Like, I don't need to, just because you like your current broadband internet doesn't, like, that's totally irrelevant to this story about Starlink. And honestly, your personal vendetta against The Verge because they once misdescribed something that you did is like, okay. But also, the other one that kind of infuriated me is there was somebody, Neelay apparently has a house in rural upstate New York. And this person's immediate response is, oh, it's so great that there's internet for the rich people who have a country estates. And I'm like, actually, you're a jerk, because rural broadband is a serious issue for a lot of poor people in rural America who need access to the internet to live their lives, and they don't have any good access, including, I will say, where I grew up. Where I grew up, I think the last time I checked, they had 3G, and they had cable internet that was very slow in some places, but in most places you had to do satellite internet, which is expensive and slow and really super laggy.
Yeah.
Like DirecTV, and I mean, kind of
as Neelay's article points out too, the current like FCC broadband, what describes as broadband, is like 25 megabits, which is not great.
So this is, but my point in praising this piece and linking to this piece is, I love this story, and the reason I love it is because it's not about one thing. It's not. Sometimes I'm reviewing Apple products and I'm like, well, this product is not that interesting, but it brings up some interesting issues, right? And that's like, I can write about the big issues and I can kind of weave a story. And I appreciate when I see that in other people's work. I've always admired Neelay's writing. I think he's a really good writer. And this is what he's doing here. Neelay has a lot of knowledge and opinion about how broadband has been handled in the United States, mishandled in the United States. Mm-hmm. And this article is not just about Starlink. In fact, he's pretty generous to Starlink. It's a beta. They are supposed to be launching more satellites. It's got, you know, they make some weird product decisions, but it's a beta, right? He didn't even give it a Verge rating, which is fine because Verge ratings really only go from about 6 to 9. So, you know, it would be in there somewhere, probably in the 6s. Who knows? But what it's about is about the U.S. failure. This product exists because the U.S. has failed to do broadband properly. That if the U.S. was in Europe, it would be the most expensive broadband in Europe, right? Compared to other industrialized countries, our internet is terrible and expensive. And the FCC has not promoted competition. There are no rules to force things like the leasing of fiber or things like that so that you can have competition among providers while still allowing the people who built the infrastructure to make money. And instead, they have this policy that's like, well, alternate forms. So like, well, the competition to cable will be cellular, except that's also failed because the cellular companies also don't invest, especially in rural areas, in doing high-speed internet.
Or things like DSL, which, you know, have limitations in how they're deployed and are much slower.
And are not really competition, right? That was I now have fiber in my neighborhood, so I now have competition for the first time. But for the longest time, the only competition was my old DSL that I had and cable. And DSL was not competition.
We actually do have two cable companies in Somerville, but if you go next door to Cambridge, I think they only have one.
Yeah.
And I looked up at some point recently. Like yeah. And I looked up someplace recently to see whether or not they had talked about doing fiber in Somerville, because there is no fiber in Somerville right now. And I found a report from, like, you know, a committee in the local government saying, like, we essentially are advocating basically you can't do like the deep fiber as easily here, right? Like, it's supposed to be buried way underground, but you can do sort of like a lower, like a shallower level fiber. And like, they advocated, like, hey, whenever we're digging up roads for anything, we should lay fiber. Mm. Like, just because, well, as long as we're down there, we should do it so we can build the infrastructure. I was like, oh, this is great. And then I discovered that the pandemic put all of that on hold. Ah. So none of that has happened, which is like, oh, so close.
The last point I wanted to make about Nele's story is that he points out the other controversy involving Starlink, which is that they are launching thousands of satellites in order to create this. And that has huge ramifications for telescopes, because if you do a long exposure on a telescope in order to see something far away, what you end up getting is streaks through your image because a satellite or two zipped over, and that there are so many Starlink satellites that it's actually a serious potential hazard to astronomy. And Nele's point is, how absurd is it that the United States' failure to do proper broadband policy is going to ruin ground-based astronomy for the world? Like, really? Anyway, my point is, it's a story about like five different things in one, and I really appreciate that by somebody who knows and is passionate about the subject. And that's why I like that story. So you want to read?
I read it as well. It was
Broadband
it was a really
dreams
good read.
Fall to Earth.
Yeah. As someone with a lot of family in other parts of New York that are more rural, and, you know, I've definitely heard from them the challenges of getting good internet in those places. And, you know, like, it's like we both said, like, we've even in a place with like that's urban, you have problems because of the fact that the competition doesn't exist. And, you know, we've linked, I'm sure, to a lot of stuff on the Six Colors in the past. I know I have, even in the last few months, talking about the challenges with this in terms of like what internet providers basically get away with because of the fact that there's no competition and very little regulation. And the answer is a lot.
So anyway, people can check out that story if you like. I thought it was a good read. Nele has been, you know, he's written about like net neutrality, and like one of these days somebody's gonna put Nele on the FCC. That's what they should do. Put him on the board. Put him on the board. Make him a commissioner of the FCC. I think he'd be great at it. Or maybe he'd be terrible at it because he'd say the truth and nobody wants to hear that. I don't really know. My Macworld piece this week, which I talked about on Upgrade a little bit, sort of when it was forming, but I'm interested what you think about this, which is, do you think Apple's going to replace potentially the MacBook Air with a new consumer laptop design that's thinner and it doesn't have the kind of wedge shape, and it's going to be, and in colors like the iMac colors, and be kind of the new MacBook, maybe even called MacBook, who knows, because that's marketing, so it could be anything. And my piece in Macworld was basically like, sounds great. If you're going to do this, you better kill the MacBook Air, because the last time you tried this, people just kept buying the MacBook Air, and you ended up killing the MacBook and keeping the MacBook Air. So what do you think Apple's going to do about consumer laptop, given all of the kind of rumors?
I think you're right, and I think the biggest challenge with the MacBook, as I think you touched upon in Upgrade at least, was it was expensive. And that was a problem because Apple needs a laptop that comes in at that $1,000 price point, basically.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be the best laptop in the lineup. It doesn't need to be the most powerful laptop in the world, but it needs to be there, because if your laptop started at $1,300, it's expensive, and it's gonna, if nothing else, get a lot of people talking about how, you know, oh my god, like, you can buy a PC for $500, and it's like, yeah, you can, but you know, you need to have something that at least plays in that $1,000 price point. I think there's a good argument for using the MacBook name, especially because the fact that the MacBook Air that we have now, that's based on the M1, is basically a carbon copy of the Intel MacBook Air that came before it.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense to say, like, hey, we're doing this first transition,
which is itself a carbon copy of the non-Retina MacBook Air that's been around since 2012 or something like that, right? It's like
pretty much. I mean, a little with some subtle differences, right?
But yeah. Right, but not a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I would not at all be surprised to see the color return. I think that with the iMac blazing the way there, it would be weird if they didn't do color on the laptops.
Then I agree.
Then the iMac looks strange because it's the odd man out on the lineup.
Yeah.
I think with the MacBook Pro, and this is where it gets interesting, because I think both the larger iMac and the MacBook Pro that we haven't seen yet, I think that is the question of, as we've discussed many times before, does Apple believe the color is a consumer feature and not a pro feature? And pros want serious looking computers that are silver or maybe gray or maybe space gray.
Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly think at this point they could go either way on that. And at least, you know, maybe there's a silver model available as with the iMac, but there are also colors available. But I think on the consumer line, I think it's a shoe-in. From the Air standpoint, I don't know. I mean, it's been so successful for them. I can understand why they would want to maybe do a device that is different than that. But the brand name has some cachet to it. And I don't know that going to MacBook, though it simplifies things, and I know Apple fans are always about, like, ah, I want to get that lineup right back into that 2x2, right? The consumer pro laptop desktop matrix that Steve Jobs showed off 20 years ago. But I think that there's an argument for keeping the Air name, if only because it is recognizable and sort of enshrined now. That said, they clearly have no, you know, problems with ditching stuff with any connection to history. So I could see them going to MacBook. They could come up with an entirely new name to go in there as well. But yeah, I think that the color version is likely, and I find it interesting because having revamped the MacBook Air last fall, it also makes me wonder what is the refresh time frame on these. And we talked about this a little bit in the past in terms of the Apple Silicon and how fast they're doing updates to it. Is this a thing that revs every year like the iPhone chip, or is this a thing that is more on a couple year cycle? And I don't think we have enough data points to know that for sure right now. But I do agree, and I remember you talking to Mike about this, where he was listing off all the stuff that he wanted to see in, like, you know, MacBook, and you're like, yeah, but then it's too expensive, right? Like, you can't get that mini LED screen in there. You can't have
for $999
all the ports. Yeah, exactly. Your whole point is you need to hold down that price point at the bottom. So maybe, you know, you on the upsell, right? Like on the higher end models, it has those, but the base model is going to look, I think, pretty much, you know, hardware wise, like the MacBook Air looks right now. It might be in a slightly smaller package, but like, I think you're still not going to have more than two ports. I think you're going to have, you know, a Retina display, but not a mini LED display. I think you're going to have a lower version of the chip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a binned version of whatever your processor is right now, or just keeping around the older processors.
Yeah, that's my theory. Is if this is truly a new MacBook, but it's going to use the next generation chip, which I'm not entirely convinced of, but this is supposedly a, like, late this year or early next year kind of thing. So let's say that there's an M2, and then there's also, like, there's like an M2X or something like that goes in higher end models. That's my theory, is that they'll do, if they get rid of the MacBook Air and they introduce this thing, they're going to have to do like a reduced version that's $999 that doesn't have as many colors, or maybe doesn't have colors and has the M1, not the M2, and has, maybe it doesn't have the same screen or doesn't have all the ports, or, you know, they'll pick whatever they need to do that they feel like fits under at $999. But I don't think they can release a snazzy new MacBook at $1,199 and keep the existing M1 Air around at $999, because, I mean, they can do whatever they want, but I feel like they're risking the replay of the old situation, which is that the new model that's supposed to be their standard bearer and is going to be the future is going to spend a year or two not selling very well because people just keep buying the M1 Air because it's great.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a capable product. The question is, what does a $1,199 MacBook bring that a $999 MacBook Air doesn't have? And I think the line is so thin at that point right now. I mean, you know,
well,
even the
and it's easier
the
to
iPad
upsell
Air,
inside
iPad
a product.
Pro,
it's easier to say, well, yeah, but do you want the colors? Because then it's just a little bit more. But if it's two separate products, I think it's a lot harder to make that claim.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the iPad Air, iPad Pro, you get an example of that breakdown, right? Which is to say,
exactly,
the iPad Pro has a lot of stuff going for it, but the iPad Air has so much of what's good. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, unless you really want that Pro, like, you know, you really want that or really need it, or you want that larger screen size, for example, right? Like, that's a compelling argument.
Yeah, or now they've got a faster processor, but it's a limited set of things. It's not a massive spread between them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, also, the naming, I think, is, and I think Mike made this point, the naming thing where Apple seems to be really driving toward the idea of having product and product pro. Like, and they've been
iPhone,
doing
iPhone
versions
pro,
of it, but like really being much more disciplined about, there's iPhone and iPhone Pro. So there's iPad and iPad Pro, and there's iPad Air in there too. It's true. And then there's MacBook and MacBook Pro. You could make the case that that actually follows. If I bought a laptop, it would not probably be a MacBook Pro. It would probably be a MacBook. But on the desktop, I would love to buy a computer with color, is what I'm saying. And I, like you mentioned, I'm a little concerned that if Apple offers colors on Pro models, they're going to be, like on the iPhone, it's going to be like a muted color. It's going to be that dark navy or the dark green or something like that. It's going to be, you know, midnight blue or midnight green or other sort of like absolutely you can't see color, right? And that is less exciting to me than these iPop and iMac colors that are fun.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. And the only thing that will make me sad about it is I have an M1 Air, and I don't think I can justify buying a new computer the following year just because it's fancy and has color. Yeah. But that said, I will say that I think the legacy of the MacBook, in terms of the thing that is sad about the way it got discontinued, is that like the idea of that super slim computer, I think, has a lot of appeal. You and I both have a lot of fondness for the 11-inch MacBook Air, and there isn't a computer in Apple's lineup that matches that. And I think, you know, the idea of bringing back something in the MacBook range just to provide a smaller, lighter experience does have a lot going for it. The question is, you know, we went from a time where, I mean, even the original MacBook Air, right, was sold at a premium, and it eventually came down and became sort of the consumer level, you know, laptop, right? But like, it wasn't for a while. It was an expensive premium because it was the slimmest and the newest, and everything had to fit into it, and it was so tightly engineered that it cost more. But they figured out how to like flatten that curve and essentially turn it into a much more consumer producible notebook at a good cost. And if they could do something like that with the MacBooks, they're like, all right, hey, it's the new slim one. And because especially with all the stuff right now, like the problems that they had to solve in making the MacBook are problems that Apple Silicon kind of solves for them, right? Like they couldn't have too powerful a chip because of the cooling stuff. It's like, wow, you don't barely need cooling for the M1, right? Like there's no fans in the Air right now. And that was a thing that was like a big deal on the MacBook. So, you know, you can kind of get away with some of those things now that you have Apple Silicon because it allows for a different engineering around a product. If you can fit an M1 in an iPad Pro, you can fit an M1 in a slim Mac. It's definitely possible. So maybe there's an argument there. I don't know. Is there a MacBook Slim or a MacBook Mini, perhaps, just to continue that line of thought?
Oh boy.
I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's interesting to watch them try to figure out how to do this transition. But like I said on Upgrade, I think I'm one of the things that excites me about this next phase that really has begun with the iMac is we're starting to see Apple's redesigned hardware instead of the first M1s, which were in the old hardware, right? Like literally in some cases, just with room, like empty space, because they just use the old enclosure.
Well, you know what? The thing that is, I don't know if it's quite sad is perhaps too strong a word, but the thing I thought interesting this week as the benchmarks of those M1 iMacs have started to sort of leak out, and people are like, surprise, it's an M1. Like, duh. Is I think it makes the idea of those new benchmarks in some ways like a little anticlimactic, I guess, right? Because like we're entering a future where Apple's going to put out these chips, and those chips are going to appear in multiple different Macs. And even though Intel publicized its roadmap, and you could kind of say like, oh, this is the chip that's probably going to go in the MacBook Air, or this is the chip that's probably going to end up in the iMac, you know, there were always slight differences in how they clocked and just sort of like the implementations. Whereas on the M1 side, it seems like the ground is the playing field. It's really even, right? Like the M1 Air that you're getting in a, you know, the M1 that you're getting in the Air is the M1 that you're getting in the iMac, is the M1 that you're getting in the Mac Mini, is the M1 that you're getting in the iPad, right? And it's like, well, we kind of know when Apple comes out with a new chip, like, well, that's going to make it probably in most of, if not all of Apple's products eventually. So it does take away a little bit of the surprise about it. But and that's nice from a perspective of being able to predict where these things are going. It's like, oh, well, I can get it. I'll know that in 6 months, for example, I'll be able to get a laptop with that chip in it probably. And that's good. But yeah, it takes away some of the mystique of it, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. Interesting times, I would say. Interesting Indeed. Times. Anything else going on?
There's so little. Not a lot. No. It's very quiet. It's the calm before the storm.
Well, yeah, I think everybody's hoping that the new iMacs and iPads will actually arrive in people's hands, like, what, end of next week?
Yeah, I think they're supposed to. I don't know. I've seen a bunch of different ship dates. It seems like the whole, shipping delays thing is playing a part.
Right.
Yeah, so.
But I've seen some people report that there are, like, iPads that have shipped but are now being held because there obviously is going to be some sort of
a drop date.
Who knows when it is. So maybe those will be in people's hands next week and we'll have more to talk about.
Probably true. They probably want a little bit of space between that and WWDC. So
you'd think, which is also coming soon. Oh boy,
very soon. I mean, it's fascinating to see those iPads are going to drop about 2 weeks before WWDC. At which point, everyone's going to find out whether or not the hardware they spent all this money on will be able to have commensurate software features.
Yeah,
interesting
should be. Well, that's it for this edition of the Six Colors podcast. But thank you, as always, for subscribing and listening. And until next week, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.